Continue to the second lecture of today, Dr. Anastasia Pilyavsky from Girton College in Cambridge. Please welcome.
Right, so I wasn't quite aware of the fact that I will be speaking to a group of students. So I am hoping that what I'm going to talk about today isn't going to sort of fly over your heads. I'm sorry, I don't have videos or even pictures, so I'm going to speak and I'll hope that I'll keep your attention for an hour. And of course, it's Shuni has set up a very hard act to follow with all those bloodlettings and amazing things that we just saw. So if something doesn't make sense, if you have not understood, just raise your hand, and then it's important that you stay with me when I'm speaking.
Excuse me.
I should go back.
Here's my microphone. So just keep close to the...
Right, okay. I'll stay close to the microphone. So my work is on politics, and politics in India, and I work in the North Indian state of Rajasthan. So we're traveling right across India from the southeast to the northwest. And there is a real connection between Shimi's work and mine insofar as what Shimi was showing you is how this very, very old system we call caste, system of jatis, of groups that insist on being different but also somehow connected, how it shapes life today, very many forms of life today, from marriage to getting money out of the government. And my work does something similar in trying to show how old political forms, so forms of kingship, feudal forms, forms of having hierarchical relations with people who are your governors or your rulers, how they continue to shape democratic politics in India today. And the thing that is distinctive about India when we think about democracy. There's something about it. Does anyone know why India is such a particularly interesting place to study if you want to understand how democracy works? No? Well, it's the world's biggest democracy. Have you heard such a thing? No? It's a remarkable sort of fact because... it's got more than 1 billion people living in it. Of course, not all of them are voting. Some are children and some are immigrants. But a very large, so 800,000 people are, 800,000, what is it? 800 million, sorry, I can't even think in numbers that large. Yes, 800 million voters, right? And when the general election, so the national election, takes place, it's the single biggest social organized event in the world, right? It's a crazy thing that happened. And in a society that's this complex and this differentiated, as you got a sense from Shimi's talk, it's a remarkable achievement, yes? And not only is it just that a lot of people vote, they vote with incredible enthusiasm. So the voter turnouts in India are some of the world's absolute highest. So they vote much more than most countries in Europe and more than even the United States, which is a very politically, in the West, it's a very politically engaged country. Okay, so that's a little bit of background. And my paper or my talk is really, as I said, about old forms of political affiliation and how democracy in India works through them. And it's based on research that I've been doing in Rajasthan for the past 12 years, but really I did very focused research in 2013, and I spent most of the year in Rajasthan in India, following politicians, running around after them, going on their buses, asking people what they thought about them. It's the kind of thing that very few analysts of politics actually do. A lot of political scientists, they do quick surveys, they sit and talk about high theory, but they don't really know very much about what people themselves think they're doing. And that's what I'm trying to contribute to the discussion. So let's begin. In the Royal Assembly, the King receives his visitors in two separate rooms. The commoners he receives in something known as the Common Assembly, and the special visitors he receives in the Special Assembly. The first one is called in India the Diwan-e-Aam. So if anyone... You've been to India, no? None of the ones remaining here have been to India? You have been to India, right? So this Common Assembly occupies a green, spacious courtyard, which every morning fills with petitioners who are seeking audience with the king. The courtyard leads through a screen door into the inner chamber where the king receives royal visitors, aristocrats, or notable visitors from abroad. The commoners come separately or in groups, and the king, when he does appear, dispenses various gifts, and he often adjudicates conflicts. Now, the king in question, about whom I'm speaking here, is not an old-time king, but a member of the Rajasthan State Assembly, whom I shall call here Mr. Singh. Now, Mr. Singh is one of Rajasthan's most colourful political figures, whom I came to know very well in the course of this year of research in Rajasthan in 2013. Before I met him, I was told that the best place to get hold of him, because it was really difficult to find, I kept chasing around and trying to find him in his official office, and I couldn't find him there, stupid me. And I was told, well, the best way to get hold of him is to go to his private office, because he also runs a real estate company. It took a few trips and several hours of waiting before we finally met, but while I waited, I learned a lot about him from his assistant, his peon, a man who serves him coffee and sweeps his floors. The peon was a small, chatty man who came from this member, from this politician's native village, and he cheerfully told me, within minutes of meeting me, how many houses his boss has, how many businesses, how many fancy cars, how many children, how many mistresses, and mobile phones, and all sorts of things. Suddenly I knew. I learned about how many elections Mr. Singh had stood for and lost previously, and I learned that when he was a young student leader, he amassed a following in the University of Rajasthan by bullying, intimidating his professors, and getting his mates to get good exam grades without them ever having to sit exams. He was very popular. While we chatted away, I heard a car stop outside. Was this boss, I thought? No way, laughed the guy I was speaking to. You won't miss boss when he arrives. When he comes, there's a big, huge tamasha, a big spectacle. All the doors slam open, everyone leaps out, and then again, all the doors slam shut, and you'll hear bang, bang, bang. Well, sure enough, in a few minutes, I heard a great hubbub outside, and in stormed boss. He was quite a tall man, who was sweating and swearing and demanding food. On his part, the peon flew into a kind of frenzy. He hunched low and dashed around and started getting food and water, and all the while murmuring this one word, hokum, hokum, which is an honorific that is used in India, traditionally, to greet kings and high aristocrats. So the men who trailed behind boss were also stooping and saying the same hokum, hokum. I've seen this kind of performance, this choreography, many times before, the same tilted backs and commands and noises of deference. I've seen it over the years in royal households I've chanced to visit in Rajasthan. There are lots of kings and princes in Rajasthan, so it's not that difficult to meet one. But I've also seen it whenever I followed various politicians of whatever party affiliation or style, political style. I remembered when I saw Boss for the first time, waiting for somebody who's since become the chief minister of the state of Rajasthan, so the top politician. I remembered waiting for her in the lobby of a 5-star hotel. She was in the middle of her electoral tour, and when she finally emerged from her room, those who were awaiting her, who were high-ranking politicians, lawyers, even a parliamentarian from Delhi, they all rushed to her feet, touching them rapidly, one by one, right? So there was a queue, and they just touched her feet, one after another. And in return, she tapped their heads like this, in the way that grandmothers or aunts touch the heads of their children, as a sort of a blessing from a superior person, from an older person. So the crowd of these people who were so eager to greet the woman was large, and it took, and I sort of was looking at my clock, it took half an hour, 27 minutes, before Miss Rajay could actually proceed from her hotel. And by the end of it, she was pretty irritated and exhausted, right? But this is what happens every time she comes out, every single day, right? And she's got 15-hour-long days where she's going in 40-degree heat from village to village campaigning. So this is not something that she really wanted. This was something that was imposed on her. All the while this was happening, she beamed a steady smile, expertly hiding the impatience she later said she feels at such rituals. As we bounced along a surfaceless road in her tour bus later that day, she told me she hated this hullabaloo, she called it. She has a very sort of old English that she speaks, a kind of colonial English. I hate this hullabaloo, which according to her was a waste of time. But what can we do, she said. This is our culture. This is how our people show their love. Well, at times of election, India's cities and villages overflow with this kind of love. And in the year I spent stalking Rajasthan's politicians, I must have seen thousands of people fall to their feet, hundreds place crowns and turbans on their heads, dozens and dozens present them with swords and royal symbols. Mr. Singh, now remember Mr. Singh, the boss, right? Mr. Singh has a room full of swords he'd been given, literally hundreds of them, which he has no heart to discard. He gave me one when I left. I really asked him, can I have one to take back? And how I got it back to England is another story. So the royal garb, the royal paraphernalia, it really quite becomes Miss Rajay, the chief minister woman, yeah, who is actually an heir to a royal dynasty in a nearby state, and who's popularly known as the Maharani, which means, does anyone know what the Maharani is? No? Queen. Yep. Of course, her critics call her the Maharani with contempt, you know, as a, you know, she's an old-fashioned, sort of corrupt kind of politician, but her followers call her the Maharani with love. Mr. Singh, the boss, is a completely different kind of animal. He is an aristocrat by birth, but he's neither royalty, nor is he really interested in having crowns put on his head. On the contrary, his style is very populist. He is, he launched his career by advocating the causes of the Jaipur's working classes, and Jaipur is the capital of Rajasthan, where I did my work. Although at the time of research he represented Civil Lines, which is a very wealthy locality in Jaipur, most of his voters and his following come from the slums, which crowd around the city's central middle-class lanes, where he lives. As a student leader, Mr. Singh was celebrated for leading rickshawalas. Everyone knows what a rickshawala is? Yeah. Okay.
Maybe you could explain a few words.
So the rickshaw is a people's taxi, and there are all sorts of rickshaws that have been in India, that people drive in India and have been driving in India for a very long time. One kind is a completely pedal rickshaw where a man drags a cart, and those have been pretty much outlawed. The last place they had them was in Calcutta, in Bengal, so it's northeast India, where a man just pulled a cart walking. Most rickshaws are either cycles, so they're tricycles, where you have a seat in the back and you have a family who sits and you cycle. So it's a poor man's, it's a straightforward poor man's way to earn money. And a fancier ride is a sort of a fancy motorcycle, again a tricycle but motorized, with a little cabin. I wish we had pictures. Anyway, so these are, this is the real working class, right? And a lot of these men, they either are just live in local slums, or they come from villages and they have come to cities, they bought this tricycle, the family pooled money together, bought a rickshaw, and then they send their earnings back to support their families, right? So these are real working people. So this Mr. Singh, he led the rickshawwalas and railway workers into protests, which earned him the reputation of a kind of a gangster but a go-getter leader, and earned him a criminal record in courts of law. Because occasionally during protests he would slap a policeman or a government servant, and a case would be filed against him. So that was some time ago, but rickshaw drivers around town still love to tell stories about how in those days Mr. Singh did something as brave as slapping a district magistrate across the face, and he broke a stone fence in Jaipur's municipal corporation. So you saw pictures of a lion in one of the posters. They often call him, well, Singh literally means lion in Hindi. So they say, you know, his name even means lion. But he's very unroyal in his manner. He wears blue jeans, and he's got shirts with sleeves always rolled up, and he speaks in a kind of coarse language, which is laced with dirty words often. He's very much a common man's politician, and he doesn't speak any English, and he's much more at ease in the company of taxi drivers than in the company of his fellow politicians, who are many of whom come from middle-class elite families who speak English and who have a much more refined manner. And yet, when he's on stage and when he's campaigning, he wears his crowns that are put on his head no less convincingly than Miss Rajay. So Indian politicians of different sorts, Mamata Banerjee, I suppose these names won't really mean anything to you, have all been styled not only as royals, but also as gods. And earlier this year, the former minister of Andhra Pradesh built a temple for Sonia Gandhi. Has anyone heard of Sonia Gandhi? Sonia Gandhi is an Italian woman who married... Has anyone heard of Indira Gandhi? Indira Gandhi? Yes. Okay, good. So Indira Gandhi had two sons, yes? And Indira Gandhi was... the head of the Congress Party, which was the only party India had until the late 70s. Yes, the Congress Party was an organization that fought for India's independence, and once they got their independence, it became the political party. And this political party has been run from India's capital basically by one family. And the first person who ran India was someone called Nehru, Jawaharlal Nehru, right? And Indira Gandhi was his daughter. And she had two sons, and Sonia Gandhi met one of her sons while he was studying in Cambridge, Rajiv Gandhi. She married him. She was a waitress in a restaurant. Okay, and she married him, and then he was shot, like a lot of the Gandhis were shot, and like his mother, she was shot. And Sonia has been since, the leader of the Congress Party. She isn't Prime Minister, but it was widely understood while the Congress Party was still running the country that she actually ran the country. But she was too terrified of also being shot to actually become Prime Minister. That was the story, okay? So there's Sonia Gandhi. So just earlier this year, the former Minister of Andhra Pradesh built a temple to her, and she's now worshipped as a goddess called Telangana Tali, the mother of Telangana, right? And the patron goddess of the new state of Telangana. This state has just been created. And she played a very key role in its creation. So the bronze Miss Gandhi is executed in a classical South Indian style, and she stands 9 feet tall and weighs 500 kilograms. She holds in her right hand ears of maize or corn, and in the left a plate full of grain, symbols of Telangana's future prosperity. So incidents of politician worship, they cause a lot of funny commentary in the press, right? People sort of mock this, and they say, oh, this is part of the sort of eccentric and archaic culture of Indian political life. They say this is idolatry. Idolatry, wrote one commentator on this new goddess-like image of a politician, said, continues even in these modern times as a prominent culture of deification. But more serious commentary on such incidents express despair. They treat them not merely as sort of funny cultural quirks, but as symptoms of a serious political problem. They treat these sorts of royal or lordly practices as signs that much of India's population is still mired in a kind of backward, old-fashioned feudal political mode. And because they're treating their politicians, who should be political representatives, as kings or even gods, that means they're really undermining the foundations of democratic principles. So the critics say that here politicians run their constituencies like kingdoms, and they distribute influence and resources down personal lines of command, and instead of really legislating, making policies on behalf of their voters, they spend time personally giving gifts and favors. In this top-down system, the drastically disempowered citizens are left to beg or to appease, to fall at the feet of politicians, and that sometimes takes the form of this crazy sort of god-making of politicians. Critics say that, well, you can be very enthusiastic about India's democratic success, that many people come out and vote, but this is not really democracy as democracy should be. It's democracy gone peculiar and topsy-turvy. It's democracy upside down, where the proper power relations, where it's the people who should be in power, are turned upside down. Here politicians, they say, aren't people representatives, but sovereigns or royal kings who turn citizens into subjects whom they rule, sometimes quite slave-like. Well, what I'm trying to express and convey to my audiences and to you today is that we can understand them as democratic, and the point of my talk to you today is to explain why it is that we can see them as expressions of people's power, which is what democracy should be. Democracy, it's a Greek word, right? Yes? Which literally means demos, is the people, and kratia means power, so it just means people's power. The talk's about whether we can think of Indian politicians dressed as they so often are in royal garb as acting for their electors, not just commanding them or telling them what to do and exercising power over them. More broadly, it's about questions of political responsibility. How, through, in what ways do many of Indian citizens allocate political responsibility, so hold their politicians responsible? And what might treating political leaders like gods, kings, or bosses, or overlords, have to do with making politicians accountable for delivering what voters want from them? At the end, I'll bring all of this home, turning these questions onto our own ideas and confusions about democracy, to say a couple of things about some intellectual and political lessons that this prevalence of kingly style of politics really teaches us and shows, teaches us in countries further north. I see confusion. Are we lost now? Do you stop me and if you find this? Yeah? Is it okay so far? Yes? But let's return to Mr. Singh. Every morning, Mr. Singh holds these public meetings, which are known as royal assemblies. People actually call them that without irony. By 8 o'clock every morning, the front yard of his house fills up with people, petitioners, seeking all kinds of help. Some come alone with personal problems, like troubles with their neighbors or with the police, with an illness or a wedding. But most arrive in groups who are asking for public goods, like street pavements or lights, or a set of gates to block off their colony, which is the latest middle-class craze in India. Some of them come asking for land in their neighborhood to be regularized, which means to become legal. So many of them are living on land illegally, but they've been living there for decades, sometimes for generations, but it isn't legal, and it's a very contentious issue because once your land is legalized, you can get electricity at cheaper rates, water, and all sorts of facilities, which otherwise you buy from private companies at a much higher price. So one cool February morning, I was hanging out, as usual, in Mr. Singh's court, and I joined a group of women there. These women were clearly working class women because they were wearing these cheap synthetic saris. Remember that Shimi said that to us she doesn't look like any kind of a person belonging to any kind of caste, but there are all these subtle things, especially in clothing, jewelry, that show which caste you belong to. So these women were wearing cheap synthetic saris tied in a kind of unfashionable village way. There are lots of ways to tie a sari. That may be something we should do in the evening, a sari tying lesson. And they said that they came from a slum near the train station nearby. Not a kind of tent city for migrants, which we think every slum is, right, with cardboard, no. It was a neighborhood with concrete and brick houses, some of them actually two or three stories high, the kind of neighborhoods that most of the city's well-established working classes live in. The women complained that the communal water tap on their street, so they're sharing one tap, yeah, it had dried up, and that they feared that something bad was going to happen. They told me that the colony has been there since the late 1970s, when some of their families first arrived from a southern state of Gujarat. They said it hasn't yet been legalized or regularized, but neither has it been demolished. The fate that recently befell several other slums just like this in the city center. So they had really good reason to be worried because sometimes bulldozers come and they just take these down. And especially in a central location in a city that's developing incredibly rapidly, this land is becoming more and more expensive. You can build fancy malls and you can build multiplex cinemas, hotels and all sorts of things. So these people are in a very vulnerable position. So a vast swarm of contractors is always swarming around these slums like honeybees around a pot. Although the neighborhood has been there long enough to qualify for legalization by government law, you have to be there for 15 years in Rajasthan to be recognized and given the land legally. The residents have received in the last year, just in the last year, several demolition notices, right? So these ladies told me that these threats had been staved off, kept at bay by Mr. Singh, who is Municipal Corporation's old enemy, right? He broke their wall down back when he was a student. And he prides himself on having legalized 14 neighborhoods in Jaipur in the 5 years in office. Quite an achievement. Given the interests, the really, really weighty interests he has to fight against, so very wealthy contractors, businessmen, and government officials who get lots of bribes from these businessmen, this was great in testimony to his influence, to his real work for the people, and to his sheer political skills. So the ladies were worrying that the dry tap meant that there was going to be an attempt at demolition, right, that the bulldozers will arrive any moment. And they were coming to Mr. Singh once again to make the municipal corporation legalize their land, something that they believed was their due for more than a decade. So he's managed to keep their neighborhood without being destroyed, but he hasn't yet managed to have it legalized. It's an uphill battle. So Mr. Singh doesn't usually come out into his court until 9:30 in the morning, not before he has breakfast and his morning bath. So the ladies and I had plenty of time to chat, much of which they spent singing his praises. They were very devoted to him. The boldest woman, a large woman called Maya, told me that she called him the respected leader, and she called him her great uncle. He's done all sorts of work for them, she said. He arranged her father's treatment in hospital. He got the sons of several of the women out of police lockup, and he installed water taps around the neighborhood. And he even paid for the wedding of one Congress leader's daughter in there. So this was great work that a politician has done. But most importantly, he's kept the bulldozers at bay. Then suddenly, as he was telling me the story, there was Mr. Singh, and the women leapt up from their haunches and bolted straight for his feet, touching them, just like the politicians were touching Miss Raji's feet in the hotel. Mr. Singh quickly spotted the leader of the pack, right, the bold woman, Maya, to whom I was speaking, and she was sort of their front woman. And he spoke to her, asking her ward number, so the block, which is where people vote when elections come. And he asked for her husband's name. She named both, and he kind of recognized. And he said, oh, is this about the tractor matter? He got it wrong. She said, no. And so he said, okay, speak. Tell me, what's the matter? It was sort of a command voice. So she started mumbling something, and then he said, oh, yes, this is about your plots of land. Speak, what happened? And then finally she spoke up. She said, respected father, they turned off the water on our street. That tap you put on the street, it's all dry now. This isn't good. It won't be good, she said. How do we know what this means? This is a very classic language of Indian allusions. You don't actually say that we're worried this will happen, but you suggest, and he understands. And by doing that, you create a feeling of being close, of knowing what you're, like inside talk, right? So she said, who knows what this means? You know how it is for us poor people. He understood very well. This was February, which wasn't the dry season, and the water tap drying up shouldn't have happened on its own. It was clearly switched off. He told me later that he'd been battling the municipal corporation to legalize this block of at least 5,000 loyal voters for a long time, he said 3 years. He said these women's grandparents were living there before the motherfucker incorporation was even built. Okay, this is his language, okay? He says, you know, they're swine and they don't, they sell land to businesses and they kick off the poor people. The regularization would not only save the neighborhood, it would also give its citizens cheaper water and electricity, as I said, qualify them for public spending, and entitle them to sell their land, because this way the land sale would not really have a legal basis, and they could sell their land for a lot more this way. It would also secure for Mr. Singh their electoral loyalty. He's not just a nice guy, he's also a politician. Such things are remembered in India, and people are grateful. But Mr. Singh was up against some really powerful interests, and in this case, he was losing the fight. They're dogs in the municipal corporation, he said. Buggerers, you know. They do nothing at all, they just eat everyone's money. He really hates them. So this is, in this case, we see how we often think that democracy and and government go together, but here it's democracy fighting against the government. It's a people's representative who is fighting against bureaucrats, which often happens in India. And oftentimes the politicians win, but it's an uphill struggle. So, but to the women's lobby, he said, "Don't worry, I'll do your work." The women, they know that, you know, everyone gets shooed off and told, "Oh, we'll do your work." So they lingered, hoping that he would ring right there and then, phone up somebody in the corporation, as politicians sometimes do, and he often does. They even tried pressing him a bit. They said, "Father, do the right thing for the poor people. God will give you." They said, "Giver, yes, yes." The man standing in the queue behind them shoved them on, say, "Go, go, your giver will give you, and God will give you too." And the men laughed at these women. So till now, the men had sat on the plastic chairs, which every morning Mr. Singh's assistant sits outside, the assistant who told me such a great deal about Mr. Singh in the first instance. The women didn't dare to sit on the chairs, because women usually feel it's not their right to sit on something as nice as a chair. So I struck up a conversation with one of these young men who are much more forward and much more self-respecting. So I was talking to this man who was laughing at the women who sort of shooed them on. He said that these women were probably from a village too backward and frightened as much as to sit in front of the politician. He said, "This is village people behavior." And he beamed at me sort of knowingly. There was something to what he said. In Indian villages, children and women and sort of lesser standing men don't sit in front of their superiors, and the chairs are treated with special respect, a bit like thrones, where hosts can seat important visitors or where the head of the family usually sits. So this young man carried on laughing at the women. They said, "Babuji, father," or "giver." He was laughing at the old-fashioned words that the women used in relation to the leader. "They don't understand," he said. "What is a politician? These people have very simple thinking. They think he's like a king, a Raja Maharaja, that he can give something to them. How can he fix their tap?" This is him still carrying on. "They don't understand what is government." Well, the young man himself was at this royal court for two reasons, he told me. First, he'd been trying to get Mr. Singh for the third day to rescue his younger brother, who was caught stealing from the police. The brother was locked up in the police. He wasn't stealing from the police. So clearly he thought that while taps weren't Mr. Singh's jurisdiction, the police clearly were. So his was very forward-thinking. And he wasn't wrong. Mr. Singh does have a stronghold over the local police. As it later turned out, the young man also had more long-term plans. Like many young men who beat about in front of Mr. Singh's house, he was trying to make himself useful, and he was hoping that Mr. Singh would eventually notice this and take him under his wing. Perhaps he could become his helper, then maybe a political fixer, and then maybe he himself eventually could become a political leader himself. Well, when finally he got a moment of attention from the leader, it's a hard thing to do, their brief exchange went like this. Mr. Singh said, "Speak, what's your business?" very impatiently. And suddenly, here was a young man who was speaking so boldly to me and was laughing at these women who were supplicating. He suddenly folded his hands, turned his eyes down, and said very timidly, "I've come about my brother." Well, Mr. Singh prides himself on remembering all his constituents by face and name, and you notice he didn't recognize those women, although he pretended to, right? But as with the women, he couldn't remember who the boy was. Although the boy says he's been there for 3 days straight, right? "Which brother?" Mr. Singh said abruptly. He said, "The police matter," mumbled the boy. "Dear leader." And again, he called him grandfather. So Mr. Singh fixed his eyes on the boy, and then he seemed to remember, or at least he pretended he remembered. "Oh, yes, yes," he said vaguely. I will speak to Inspector Sahab, Sahib. What else? Well, the boy said, in our block, many people are shifting to the BJP. And the BJP is the rival party of the Congress party to which Mr. Singh belongs. This caught Mr. Singh's attention because clearly the boy was saying something of real political use. He said, which block? 23rd, sir. So Mr. Singh later explained that he's indeed been getting reports that this particular bloc has been losing loyal voters to the BJP. The BJP was making inroads. He told me his team in this bloc was very weak and lazy, and that possibly the young man could help if he was any good. And so Mr. Singh said, do your work and I will do yours. Your work will be done. The boy bowed further, and again he sort of lingered, waiting for any further assurance that there will be a relationship. There was an implied agreement, and they've sort of agreed to do each other's favors. So the boy stumbled backwards, hands still folded like this, and head bobbing sideways in a kind of plea. And then the crowd pressed up behind him, and he disappeared. So now I'll switch a little bit to thinking about what this means for our own understanding of democracy. I'm not sure. Is democracy something that you think about very much? Do you care about it at all? Or is it sort of a joke? Because in England, for people your age, democracy is a bit of a joke. What about you? You don't really care for it. How many of you vote? All right, well then. Are you just pretending that you vote?
No, there's elections coming right now. Yeah.
So if you think it's a bit of a joke, why do you vote?
It's not a joke.
No, all right, still some good people,
yeah.
Even if it were a joke.
Okay.
I think we don't vote the bad parties get in power,
right,
because the older
that.
People, the last elections, one of these really conservative party, True Finns,
mm-hmm.
they called in English,
mm-hmm.
They won, and it became quite of a shock to a lot
mm-hmm.
of young people
mm-hmm.
because they really sort of anti-immigrants and
very right-wing,
racist.
Yep. Yes, yeah, sure.
For example, a bit homophobic
mm-hmm.
and stuff like that. So,
yep.
So I think it has mobilized lots of
okay.
young people to these
mm-hmm.
these elections, so that they don't win again.
Okay.
And there are still some great ideas with the people who are in some very obscure parties, like
mm-hmm.
the Itsenäisyyspuolue,
Independence
Party,
mm-hmm.
which is very marginal, and
mm-hmm.
they have lots of different types of people.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that they are going for is democracy 2.0, like a straight people's democracy with some kind of thing that the common people can make easy initiatives
mm-hmm.
towards the politics.
Ah, so like a direct democracy.
Yeah.
Oh, right. So
and this
mm-hmm.
kind of movement is, I think it's pretty widespread, but very scattered and divided.
Okay.
So maybe if these groups would come together
mm-hmm.
for the
So I see there is interest in democracy. Okay, well, that's very good. Because, I mean, and that is very different from Britain. There's sort of a lot of disappointment and a lot of discontent, and a lot of young people feel like, well, why vote? It's not going to make a difference. And it's not impossible that something that you were saying happened here in the last elections might happen in Britain, because there's also a very racist, anti-immigrant, right-wing party that's now become prominent, UKIP. And if that wins, maybe some more liberal-minded young people will think, oh my God, well, you know, and we just didn't vote, right? But it is as especially, I mean, in the globe, when people think about global politics, democracy really is something that's at the center of our attentions, when especially we think of less stable countries, politically less stable countries in Finland, countries in the Middle East, when their regime changes. are they going to become properly democratic? And to understand whether they're going to become properly democratic, we need to have a sense of what a proper democracy is like. Right? So, for instance, we say that formally Russia is a democratic country, right? But many people think that that's not a real or a proper democracy. Mm? And the same is what a lot of critics say, as I said in the beginning, about India, that it looks democratic, but it's not really democratic. Right? And to say something like that, you need to have a really firm picture of what really democratic means. Yeah? So to what I call a kind of egalitarian, liberal mind, the image of voters falling before politicians, touching their feet, is a sign of a kind of inequality and backwardness in politics. They find even more upsetting or embarrassing the fact that so many citizens are not forced into this kind of subordination, but seek it out themselves, often against the will of politicians. So what I was seeing was not that the politicians were forcing people to touch their feet, but on the contrary, people were doing it, and the politicians were saying, this is such a waste of time, and this is so annoying, but this is our culture, right? So at the end of her electoral tour, Vasundhara Raje, the chief minister, the grand princess, right, who hates all the hullabaloo, right, she went on stage in a remote township, and she held in her hand a piece of crumpled notebook paper, which someone had just put in her hand. She greeted the crowds and then looked at this piece of paper, and she couldn't really read it because, to be honest, her Hindi isn't great. She was brought up in a very English medium, very privileged environment. She spends more time in London when she's not in office than she does in Rajasthan. The note before her was from was scribbled in a kind of semi-literate hand. She couldn't read, and she only saw the signature. And the signature read, Choti Bai, which means little sister, who was asking Miss Raje for electricity, which she said only appears in her village 3 times a day on three days a week. And for farmers, electricity is incredibly important, especially in Rajasthan, which is a very dry state on the edge of the desert, because they pump all their water using electric pumps. So in hot seasons, it's a disastrous thing. It isn't just not being able to play computer games. Yeah. So this came up, and of course Miss Raje's sort of advertisement team thought, oh, great opportunity. So Miss Raje said, of course I'll give you all the electricity you want. And then they tried to get this woman up to hug Miss Raje, but the woman stayed on her haunches bowing the whole time. So they failed to do this nice picture, which they could put on Miss Raje's website. But anyway, Miss Raje kind of pulled herself together and said, right, well, it will all be done, and everyone cheered and applauded. Miss Raje comes from this very elite family who, on the one hand, plays this part of a queen, as she's called, but also she says, look, this is a feudal democracy. This is not a modern democracy. These are very backward people. This is, our culture is very primitive. And yet, when in action, she operates following this feudal democracy's rules. A few years back, a priest in Rajasthan made a poster in which he presented Miss Raje like a bread-giving goddess, in the same way that Sonia Gandhi was presented as a goddess. He did the same thing to her. When asked about what she thought about this, she said, well, there's nothing strange about this. This is how my followers show appreciation. So while deriding village women for their backwardness, politicians often act in the same ways, doing what everyone locally knows to be appropriate, while acknowledging that we Western people, you know, an academic from Cambridge has come to talk to her, while acknowledging that we find this weird and scandalous. You know? So we can think of this condition as a kind of dual mind. On the one hand, doing things as they are done here, but also being embarrassed. about it when confronted by the outside standards. So deference to politicians isn't always a real expression of what people who are asking them for favors believe that politicians are. People don't always think that politicians are bigger, better, or higher standing persons. We all know that in India, politicians are mocked, laughed at, derided, and only rarely do people adore them without reserve. Each moment of touching their feet is a kind of spectacle and a statement. It's a rhetorical statement by which the person who's speaking to, who's addressing a politician, makes them stand above, raises them up by doing this. The terms that people use are often explicit enough about what they want from these people. When they say, oh, you my giver, or you my father or mother, what they say is it's your responsibility to give, to do things, to protect us. These are terms which oblige the people to whom they're used to do things, very simply. The force of speaking to politicians like this, which is not something that we do, is it? I mean, it's different. The force of this rests on one simple idea. The idea that differences of status imply not only a difference of power, so the people, when they put a crown on someone's head, they don't say, well, you just, we're letting you have power over us. What they're saying is we're making you responsible for doing things. So they make them into grandees, which have to act as grandees, which have the power but also the responsibility to do more than ordinary people can and should do. So from what our own egalitarian view tells us, these appear, these, you know, bowing crowns, they appear as acts of self-humiliation or maybe marks of violence that the people are so oppressed. From the local point of view, they're in fact ways of holding those in power to account or saying that we expect you to do things. So a memorable scene I witnessed in Mr. Singh's court gives a real sense of this kind of maneuvering. So one morning I got to this place and I heard a plump little middle-class woman addressing him jumpily in a kind of hurried English, a mixture of Hindi and English that people in cities often speak. Leaders, he said, there's such a big problem in our neighborhood, so much trouble, Netaji. Please. Mr. Singh was a bit tired and he said, what's the trouble? And she said, leader, this is there's so much trouble. And he said, speak, I say. And then the woman said, we have too many dogs in our neighborhood. And he kind of woke up and he said, what? I mean, it was quite something. And the woman carried on, yes, sir, dogs everywhere in the street, so many. I have a small child, a son. He's little, she prattled on. He's afraid, so afraid when they bark, he cries all night too. Regaining a bit of composure, he was really struck by this and his sense of humor, which he has a fantastic sense of humor. I think you have to be if you're a politician in India. He said, madam, dogs are not in my department. And the woman said, but father, he said, the department of dogs is down the street in Mr. Sharma's house, which is a member of Legislative Assembly from the BJP party. So he was sort of laughing at him. But the woman was unrelenting. She increased this force of her rhetoric. She used already this word father, but she said, father, please, what will we poor people do? Right? She was speaking exactly like the women from the slums, and she was not poor people. She was very well fed and clearly not deprived. This is when Mr. Singh started losing ground, and he started to say vaguely, okay, but this wasn't enough. To the amazement of the people who were watching, she cried out, giver, this old-fashioned term that the boy was laughing at, and reached for his feet. When she finally left, so she got him completely cornered, right? And when she finally left, Mr. Singh sort of spat out, "Dogs. Did you hear that? Dogs. Who does she think I am?" But he did nonetheless give in to her pleas, asking his assistant right there and then to ring the appropriate department and make inquiries. Okay, so she really got him to do what she wanted. I later heard Mr. Joy, the assistant, make phone calls, and I heard him mentioning dogs. Well, I don't know whether the neighborhood was ever cleared of dogs, but I never saw the woman again. And to me, it didn't sound like she was a woman who was going to give up easily. She was a bit unhinged, but she used this idiom of referring to politicians as kings very skillfully, if to slightly comic effect, intensifying the terms of reference at every move. She moved rapidly from a pretty mild, respected leader to the more suggestive giver and father. And I've seen this trick, not quite as wonderfully performed, deployed many times to press claims on politicians. And I have seen politicians cringe and say that, "Oh no, we're only lowly government servants," while the people say, "No, you are the great lord of our neighborhood." Mr. Singh complained bitterly later that evening over a whiskey that people come to him with all sorts of kooky requests. "Dogs," he said, "dogs. The dogs." He couldn't believe it, but he actually gave in. He said, "Some people are crazy, but what can we do? It's our responsibility to do their work." Mr. Singh isn't really honest about his work entirely, but he's not just fibbing either. Of course he doesn't do most of his petitioners' work, and often simply he can't do what they ask him. And many people like him, politicians like him, do almost nothing for their constituents. But Mr. Singh is in his first term in office. He's only been elected once at that point, and he needs to do really hard work to secure his voters' loyalties. He and his huge team of helpers do a remarkable amount of work for his constituents, from helping with disputes and saving from the police to building roads and latrines, often using his own private funds. Of course, he's just a politician with a modest salary and a slush fund he gets from the government to do public work, but he spends a lot more than that on what people ask of him. Of course, most of these funds are black or grey money. Some of them come from his real estate business, but a lot of them come from money he pockets from businessmen. Businessmen who want to have tax cuts, which he can arrange, and who give him a chunk of the money they save. And then, of course, he buys SUVs, he has 3 houses, but he puts a lot of it back into public work. So it is a different kind of distribution system, one that isn't based on collecting taxes on a tax department collecting taxes and then bureaucratically distributing them, but on a figure at the top of this constituency collecting them personally and then again distributing them personally. You can say that this is not a very fair system because he will give more to people he favors, but also he often gives more to people who didn't vote for him, who he hopes will vote for him next time. Yeah? What's interesting in the end is that Indian politicians, although there's a lot of talk about corruption, are actually, compared to politicians in places like sub-Saharan Africa, like Russia, like Latin America, even Italy, and America, the United States of America, are much, much poorer overall. They don't have vast houses in... So this man is in the state legislative assembly, which is a very high position, but he lives quite a modest life by global political standards. Maybe not compared to Finnish politicians, I don't know, but... in the world where one can say corruption is rife, yeah? And what I think is that they distribute a lot of their money because people press them to, or else they just stop voting for them. So Western political theory, so understanding of how politics works, tells us that the history of democratization of the world is really a story of an epic inversion of power from the rule of kings from the top to the rule of the people, right? So power used to flow from the top and now it flows from the bottom. We are told that in the new democratic order, the line of command doesn't run top down, but bottom up, with autonomous citizens commanding the people whom they elect into office. We are told that this inversion has flattened these ancient hierarchies of rule, the kind of structures which have been in place for thousands of years, and emancipated the people from their earlier dependencies, turning them into sovereign citizens, equal to the people who elect, whom they elect and who govern on their behalf. Historians of political thought tell us that whether the idea of equal and autonomous free people arrived within the ancient Greek polis, right? So that's the ancient Greek polis was the first place where there was democracy. That's where they invented democracy. That's why democracy is a Greek word. So it was a huge change from a kingly rule to an assembly where people actually got together. And when movements are now to have direct democracy, right, whether the Occupy movement or all sorts of movements happening around the world now, what they want is to return to this ideal, original, ancient Greek model. Yeah? But historians of political thought say whether this idea of equality and freedom arrived from Greece, whether it was invented in Greece, or whether it was invented with more modern democracies. What are the first democracies of the modern world? Does anyone know? Which countries? Guess? Come on, have a guess.
The first democracies.
In the modern world, yes. France, okay, yeah. And?
Britain.
The United States of America. Britain is a tricky democracy. It's interesting. It was a much longer sort of trajectory. You know, we still have the Queen. Yeah. But France really introduced the first model for modern democracy, which didn't last. It didn't really stay. And then America introduced its own model of democracy, which is very different, and that's what we really inherit in the world now. So whether it was invented by the ancient Greeks or by Americans or the French, they say that freedom, equality, and democracy all go together. It's a real sort of thinking package. The same kind of idea runs through the story of India's democracy, as told by human political scientists, who say that India's democratization has flattened these hierarchies, that the pyramid that Shimi described has been sort of squashed down, yeah, into a more and more egalitarian order of groups that are more like ethnic groups, right, that aren't ranked in relation to each other, and which are all fighting over political and economic resources. In this sense, the scholars of India agree with other political scientists who think that hierarchy is democracy's worst foe. It's the worst enemy of democracy. So if true democracy, they say, then equality must be what binds electors and political representatives. It must be the relation of representation must be a contract between equal people. So an open agreement that the people you choose will speak for you, right? Will speak and act on your behalf, right? Because you can't be in the government. Somebody has to do that for you. But the kingly kind of talk, right, doesn't really fit into this definition. If we remember these scenes from this royal assembly, thinking of what was going on as a kind of contract between equals where the representative speaks on one's behalf doesn't really fit this idea of a contract, yeah? So because it doesn't fit into our idea of how politicians and electors should relate, people who talk about Indian politics have basically concluded that this isn't a real democracy, because these people, the politicians, aren't really the representatives of the people, but again, they're rulers. But I think it's otherwise. And asking us to think of representation, right, which is a key thing in democracies today, right? Only there's direct democracy only in Switzerland. Do you know that? Yeah. The people of the towns, well, not all over Switzerland, but they're cantons in Switzerland where people come out and they sit in a stadium and they have cards and they put up a green card or a red card, yes or no. Yeah? And they can't, of course, there are too many to count, so there are people who kind of judge, oh, roughly more green, roughly more red, yeah? It's great, fantastic. So it's like ancient Greece. But everywhere else in the world, we have these representative governments. So what I'm trying to ask you to think about is of representation not as a relation necessarily between equals, but as a structure of political responsibility. Yeah? And when people become disillusioned in democratic governments, as they often do, what they're disillusioned in is in their loss of ability to hold politicians responsible for their words and to make them really do what they promised to do and also what we've asked them to do. So in the scenes that I have described to you here, I think it's not really equality, but on the opposite, a kind of inequality that gives substance to the bonds between voters and politicians, and makes the latter, the politicians, at least rhetorically, and often in practice, responsible to the voters. This bond is hierarchical, not because it has anything to do with purity and pollution. This is something that Shimi talked about as an old idea of why, how the Indian castes are ranked, yeah? Or because it refers to a kind of pyramid, you know, that kind of pyramid that the Westerners imagined. It's hierarchical because it treats rank difference, yes, and not independence, but the opposite, dependence, mutual dependence, interdependence, not equality, not freedom, but mutual attachment as valuable things, things that have social value and things that have political value, okay? It's these values of rank difference and dependence and mutuality, right, that we owe something to each other, that we're bound together, right? We're not just freely choosing. We are in tightly tied connections that the Indian citizens I was talking to you about invoke when they place politicians above them, when they say, you are the one above. Yeah? And it is these values of dependence and of inequality that form the basis of their claims of political responsibility. I am really exercising your... Are you still okay, or should we take a break? It's not that long. Let me see. No, some of these are references, so I'm not going... Actually... 7 minutes? Can you hold out? Yes?
Yeah.
Okay. For the grand finale. So, anthropologists working in a really wide range of settings in different places have long written about the clear assignment of responsibility as a feature of hierarchical societies. So they've shown that in hierarchies, people who stand above have more responsibility, and people who stand below have less responsibility. It's a very straightforward kind of system. So one extreme example, for instance, are divine kingships in Africa, which are widely documented. And in these kingships, the responsibility over society and indeed over life is placed in kings completely. And the responsibility is felt to be so powerful that some kings have been ritually killed when they were gravely ill because people feared that their illness could endanger the whole population. So they ritually strangled them. This is an extreme case of placing responsibility on a king. An earlier generation of Indian anthropologists, or anthropologists of India, have written a lot about mutuality and hierarchy, where both sides were responsible to each other and dependent on the other. So what to the hierarchical kind of morality is a straightforward and good structure of responsibility to our egalitarian, free, individualist kind of mind, it looks like a system of inequality, oppression, struggle, coercion, right? And that's why it's so very difficult for us to understand the Indian system of politics, because it is its moral principles are the opposite of what we really believe. The people who are very attached to this fantasy of democracy as an expression of free will or equality, it's really difficult to see political life in India as anything as a kind of immoral, abusive and distorted way of living political life. It's worth reminding ourselves that this fantasy, actually, this fantasy that democracy, equality and freedom go together is really new in American and European history. Not long ago, political thinkers and activists in Europe and the United States didn't really think that freedom and equality were necessary conditions for democracy. So the founders, for instance, of modern democracies, both in France and in the United States, recognized that those who govern and those who are governed, right, the voters and the politicians, will never be equal. They also crucially argued that it's a jolly good thing that they shouldn't be equal. Yeah? When representative governments were first introduced in France and the United States, elected representatives, people believed, should rank higher than most of their constituents, meaning they should be from a higher class, they should have more money, they should have better education, more wealth. So representative government was instituted in full awareness that elected representatives would and should be separate, distinguished from ordinary citizens, that they should be different and stand above them. So James Madison, one of the founding writers of the American Constitution, wrote against what he thought was a silly and naive misconception of political representation as a substitute for the people's direct involvement, right? So when I said earlier that we need political representatives because all of us can't fit into the House, you know, into the Parliament, right? That's an idea that, well, actually, these people are just like us, but they take our place because there are too many of us, right? And they should be acting on our behalf. He said, this is a silly idea, and this is, you know, the founder of American democracy, which we're now following. He said this wasn't just a solution to the problem of multitude, the problem of too many people. He argued that representative democracy was supposed to be and was better if it was governed by an elite. One of the chief political theorists of the French Revolution, Abbé Sieyès, also thought that because government was a special profession, those who governed had to be suitably elevated people. It was when democracy was first sort of invented in Athens, there was a debate in which Socrates argued against democracy. And this is the same kind of government argument that these people were making in America and France. Well, Socrates said, look, if you want to have shoes made, do you go to a shoemaker? Do you go to someone who makes good shoes? Yes, you go to a shoemaker. And then he said, well, you know, if you want to have a good meal cooked, you go to a chef, right? And if you have your clothes stitched, whom do you go to, and so on, right? And then he said, if you want to be governed, do you just go to everybody, right? So the idea is that the politician requires some sort of special something, right? And perhaps training, but we don't have politician colleges, do we? We can study political science, but we can't be really trained to be a politician. So in 2015, I don't think it is possible for us to continue thinking about India as a country whose politics is a kind of incomplete or distorted version of the gold standard of democracy which we have. Today there's a democracy with a life of character of its own, which I think presents us with a third model for modern democracy after the French and the American. We may think that the ways in which India does democracy is weird, astonishing, appalling, or even ridiculous, but we can't really ignore it anymore. Of course, we can't ignore it as a political entity, but we also have to learn some intellectual lessons. And we're offered several important reminders. First, that everyone's grabbing their pencils. Finally, the conclusion. 1, 2, 3. So first, that democracy anywhere, yeah? I'd rather you actually listen to me. If you want, I can send you the paper. Democracy anywhere, whether it's Switzerland or ancient Athens or India or the United States, is a kind of mirror of the people who live there. Right? A reflection of the values which these people espouse and of the way that these people think about themselves. The second thing it reminds us of is that what we have come to mistake for a true democracy, or government underpinned by these principles of equality and personal freedom, is a reflection, actually, of the values of only some people in the world. The values which have been developed very recently in Europe and America over the last 300 years. And finally, India suggests that kingship, this old ancient style of doing governance and democracy, might be less historically discontinuous and actually less opposed to each other than we have thought. It reminds us that both systems of governance rely on the people's approval, and yes, kings too relied on the people's approval. And Niccolo Machiavelli, have you heard of such a figure? Yes. He was not just an evil monster. He was actually an incredibly thoughtful political thinker. And his little book, The Prince, was really about how to gain people's love, right? For kings, right? So he was writing for royalty, and he was writing about how it is that kings could remain kings with the people's approval. But there's also a political lesson which I think India holds, and a lesson which I think is vital. Now, I know you're completely asleep. Are you still awake? This is really about our world, and I think it's really important. I think the era that we live in has witnessed the rise of political and economic inequalities on a completely unprecedented scale, where a very, very, very small number of people own a very vast majority of the world's wealth. This egalitarian norm, this value of equality and freedom, which holds all men, as it were, to be their own masters, and which rejects any kind of hierarchy, is not, I think, unconnected from the current crisis of social, economic, and political responsibility, which Europe and the United States, and increasingly the rest of the world, because it's so connected, is faced with. I think the concept of equality and individual freedom can cope no better with the inequalities that are actual, real, and unavoidable than the values that are within Indian democratic life. The current crisis of responsibility is reflected in our own interest in things like transparency, right? Making governments absolutely visible, or auditing, or even doing things without people through computerized financial systems, but they don't work. And they don't work because when we think in terms of absolute equality, it is incredibly difficult to imagine on what terms, on what basis, to hold anybody to account. how can we hold to account the bankers of 2008, and how can we hold the political and economic grandees of our world if we think that they're actually fundamentally equal to us? Okay? Of course we have legal provisions, or we should have legal provisions, right, which in their roles as grandees hold these people to account, but in our general moral sense, we have no way of doing that. And I think this kind of Indian system has serious lessons for how it is that we might try to assign a greater degree of responsibility to people who have a greater degree of power, and also how it is that we can embrace, when we think about the world, embrace the inevitable inequalities of it, rather than reject them and say that what should really be the case is the world should be flat and equal for all. Okay.
Thank you very much for your...
You're very, very brave. My God, you've just... It was an hour and 20 minutes.
We still have to have some questions or comments.
Right.
Anyone, any questions? Yeah, I know, it's been a long day.
Well, you just said about the transparency.
Mm.
And so what would like Indian transparency in politics be like?
Mm.
Like democracy is a mirror of the people of the society. So could you apply the concept of transparency in these kind of political processes?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think the concept of transparency is antithetical. It's contrary to how people in India think that good political outcomes can be achieved. They know that you can never know anything about how the sort of the corridors of power, that those are always hidden. And that's how, by talking to one person at a time, that's how you can achieve something, rather than by sort of doing an x-ray of an organization. What's interesting is that, of course, the Right to Information Act has recently been very actively used around India. That people, so you can go to, if you want to find out sort of any kind of how somebody was hired, how a particular thing occurred within a bureaucratic office, you can file a petition, and they have to provide you with the information. And the way that, from what I understood, a lot of people are using, a lot of people are filing petitions, so the whole bureaucratic system is run off its feet because it's so many documents they have to churn up. But the way that people do it is not to find out what actually happened, but to fight their political enemies. So it's a very different idea from trying to reveal something than to kind of put dirt onto someone, if you see what I mean. Yeah? So...
Public, if the people kind of know whom to approach if they want to get some things, isn't that also kind of transparent? They know how the system works themselves.
Well, it's I'm not sure if that's transparency. It's just knowledge of how the system works. That's very different from having a complete sort of window, you know, onto everything that goes on. I mean, people are very interested in learning things that they want to learn. But they don't think that in order to clean the government, what will help is that we find out everything about what's going on in the political sphere, which is what we think. We think that if we just sort of make an x-ray picture and we can study everything, then we can get rid of all those bits of dirt. Indians are very aware that politics involves a hell of a lot of dirt. But that's how it works too, and it can work for them. And it's a question of how do you make it work for you?
It's very interesting.
Yeah, it is very interesting. Yes.
Interesting.
What's your name, sir?
Yuha. Do you have any ideas how could we apply this?
Mm.
Get get more of this hierarchical and responsible thing going on in the rest of the world.
Yeah, yeah. Well, well, it's a kind of thing that is a matter of policy making, which I think Euro-American law and international law have been very bad at, assigning greater degree of both financial responsibility and all the move in the world and all the right-wing parties. What they want to do is, I mean, one way in which it has been done is by simply taxing people who earn more, yeah? But it doesn't make them sort of personally any more responsible. But that tendency has been to, the tendency around Europe has been engulfed in right-wing political sentiments, hasn't it? Very unnervingly, right-wing parties have been on the rise, and they espouse libertarian thinking, right? On the one hand, there's a very kind of socially racist, bigoted view, but on the economic view is one of pure market economy and the reduction of taxation and the leveling of taxation, right? So I think a lot of it could be worked out not just through economic responsibility, but also through political responsibility, and that does have to be done through legal matters, and that's difficult because our moral impulse is to make everyone as equal as we can. Yeah?
Any other questions or comments?
So all of you are students of anthropology?
Ethnology.
Ethnology,
is
okay,
a, is
yeah, no,
a
fine,
right?
Yeah, sure, yeah.
And I guess there are some students from other disciplines as well.
Yeah? From which other, from history?
And business and economics.
Business and economics, okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think the rest are ethnology students.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, ethnology is, I mean, it was a bit, how do you define ethnology not as different from
that's a long story.
Okay.
It will take 5 years.
Okay.
So, but yeah, we can discuss it over beer.
We can discuss it over beer, that would be very nice. Okay, well, it's been a very long day for you, and you've been very attentive, and thank you very much.